Good afternoon.
Pop open a cold one.
I couldn't quite get my soda open.
Put that beer away. You're not supposed to drink on the air.
It's supposed to be relaxing.
Yeah. It's a drinking problem.
Considering we're breathing tons of smoke right now, hopefully you're in a nice sunny or whatever place that doesn't have tons of our national forest going up your nose. Unbelievable. So my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Bill sounds like he has his fingers up his nose, but he doesn't.
No, not really. I'm here.
He told me I couldn't call him Typhoid Bill, but so I told him I wouldn't.
Why?
I don't know. It amuses me. It's a sickness.
It doesn't amuse Bill.
Oh, yeah, you have the sickness. It's not me.
Yeah.
So you can find all of our archives, and God, it goes way back. I was talking to a group the other night, and they wanted to know what kind of shows we did. So I was fanning through our archives, just writing down the...
It's like 2009, isn't it?
Like the topics. It's like, okay, well, I can't tell you about all of them because there are too many. But pretty much anything you're interested in, and if you want the whole story, we're a good spot for that because we do very little editorializing. We let our guests do all the talking, and our idea is to make this a little bit like an audio book file. So we have lots of authors. We do, oh my gosh, we do all sorts of environmental stuff. We do a lot of political stuff.
A lot of veteran
stuff. A lot of veteran things. And if you have topics that are not on our list, which is possible, and you're thinking, well, why haven't they ever spoken to them? Could you please go on our website at wethepeopleradio.us and look us up. We've got our phone numbers.
Bob's opening your second beer already?
She's a guzzler.
Bob. What to do with him. And so anyway, shoot us the information. Our cell numbers are there. Emails are there. So we're easy to find. And what else? Anything?
I think you did it.
Boys, did I miss anything?
Double X is ready to join us.
Nice. Our guest goes by the... Oh, I have some weird echo. Did you hear me?
That would be on Double X's cell phone.
Sounds like we have Cheerios crunching in there, or Rice Krispies. There we go. So he's a radio personality, host, producer, writer, and speaker. He's an award-winning filmmaker and pilot, U.S. military veteran. Thank you for that. Investigator, designer, and entrepreneur from Southern California. He's the producer and frequent on-air contributor to Pastor Ernie Sanders' radio ministry called What's Right, What's Left. So I think we should start listening in on that. That sounds like our kind of show. Reaching 38 states and 9 million listeners from WHKW in Cleveland, Ohio. So after years of sleuthing, Double X located the original manuscript of George Washington's farewell address to the people of the United States and seeks to rescue it from the clutches of Marxist collectivists. Oh, yes, you're going to like today's topic. In the New York Public Library at 42nd Street in Manhattan, he speaks across the country on recovering Washington's farewell address and its prescient wisdom for the people.
Well,
how many people know about this? Probably not tons.
They're going to get it today.
So today is the day.
Yep.
All righty. I know you're at the shooting range taking advantage of your Second Amendment rights. We appreciate you taking a break and joining us. Where would you like to begin?
Oh, well, Aaron, it's a pleasure to join you and Bill and the We the People listeners on the broadcast with you this afternoon, and I'm at your disposal.
Well, maybe you should tell us how you stumbled across this document, and I don't know.
Yeah, why hasn't...
Were you hanging out in the library?
Yeah, why hasn't anybody been talking about this?
Right. Well, that's a long story, but I think probably most of your listeners know the answer to that, Aaron and Bill, and effectively, the story starts, I suppose, in the answer to that question, in 1933. And I say that because that's when cultural Marxism first made its way to our shores in the United States of America. You're no doubt familiar with the Frankfurt School from Frankfurt University in Germany. And in 1923, 10 years earlier, at the Frankfurt University in Germany, there was established something called the Institute of Social Research. And it was established by a bunch of Marxist revolutionaries who wanted to overthrow monarchies in Europe. And they modeled that institute on the Marx Engels Institute in Moscow at the time. So they percolated along trying to advocate for revolution in Europe for 10 years. Then in 1933, Adolf Hitler took power in Germany as Chancellor of the National Socialist Party, the Nazis. And they chased these guys out of Germany, and they landed on our shores in this country at Princeton University, at Columbia University, at Brandeis University, and at the University of California at Berkeley. Well, when they arrived here, they realized that that they were dealing with a government that was popular in nature. In other words, the people were sovereign. The revolution, in their mind, had already happened in this country. And so they realized they had to change their vernacular. So instead of calling themselves revolutionaries, they called themselves social democrats. And today we see that very moniker being used by the likes of Bill Ayers, the member of the Weathermen, and then ultimately the Weather Underground, and his common law wife, if you will, Bernadine Dorn, both of whom were responsible for dozens and dozens of bombings around the country in the 60s and 70s, including against the U.S. Capitol building and the Pentagon. And ultimately, Bernadine Dorn was responsible for a bombing in San Francisco that killed a police sergeant named O'Donnell. And she had put nails around the bomb that went off in the police station there. So these are not, you know, not your run-of-the-mill Marxists. These actually were Leninist people in that they wished to decapitate the government in the 1960s and 70s in our country. And they were products of a push in academia in our country beginning in the 1930s when these cultural Marxists arrived in our country to change the way people looked at America. And their intention was to shift people away from the traditional narrative of our nation, which effectively is that, you know, we have a limited government constitutional republic under God. And the framers of our constitution and the founders of our nation intended that we would operate as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, with sovereignty of the people. And they realized that in order for a government of popular character to work, everybody was going to have to try to, you know, think about the other guy. So, you know, we best sum that up in the Christian ethic that they were framing our country under, with Matthew chapter 7, verse 12 of the Bible, which effectively says, do unto others as you wish done unto you. And then if we look further in the Bible at Galatians chapter 5, verse 1, which says, stand fast in the liberty wherewith Christ has made you free, and be not entangled again in the yoke of bondage. So all of these themes were uppermost in the minds of the framers of the Constitution. And ultimately, when we had our revolution with the Declaration of Independence in 1776, these themes were included there. Unalienable rights granted by the Creator was the language that we heard. And then ultimately, once the revolution had concluded and it was time to craft the Constitution and build that document, they built all that in. And so ultimately, that was ratified in 1787. Then in 1789, I believe it was, the Bill of Rights was ratified, which included the First Amendment, which is, of course, freedom of religion. So there had grown in our country for some 150 years a tradition of what the Marxists called, when they came to this country, a patriarchal authoritarian personality. And so they decided they were going to have to attack that outright. So they amalgamated their Marxist ideas with modern psychology, Freud, Jung, etc., and they decided they were going to try to build a psychic cage around the American male so that he would not know or be able to, or be afraid, really, to call out the truth. And today we call that effect political correctness. And so when we look in our modern times, Aaron and Bill, and for the listeners, when we think about this, World War One, World War Two, red-blooded American boys raised as Christians went off to fight wars in far-flung places around the world, knowing right from wrong intuitively. And when they came back from correcting wrongs, then they built the greatest country in the world. Well, then the Marxists began to get traction in academia, particularly higher education in the colleges and universities around the country. So they shifted this narrative away from this American patriarchal authoritarian personality, as they described it, and they began to shift it more towards what they wanted, which was a matriarchy. And this is something that Marx had talked about in the very beginning. He and others liked the idea of a society that emotes its way through the day. So they came up with something called the critical theory. And in that critical theory, they basically rewrote history and critiqued every facet of American life to find fault with the principles and the traditions of our country. And this stuff percolated into college campuses, and young kids were trained in these ideas. So it ultimately came to greatest effect in the 1960s when one of the Frankfurt Schoolers, as they were called, these cultural Marxists, a man named Herbert Marcuse, he came up with a phrase called generation gap. And coincident with that was something called don't trust anybody over the age of 30. So they got young people to respond and react to the Vietnam War, and in so doing separated them by this cultural idea of a generation gap from the wisdom of their parents and also from the traditions of the American Republic, a limited government constitutional republic under God. So that's when Marxism really got traction. Well, as we fast forward then to the 1970s and 80s, when I underwent secondary education and, you know, our peer group, and then on into university, by this time they had managed to remove George Washington's farewell address to the people of the United States from the syllabuses, you know, from the syllabi. And so nobody ever told me about the farewell address in secondary education, and nobody ever told me about it in collegiate experience. And so in 1989, I just happened to bump into, sitting on a bookshelf, a little volume published by Congress in 1937, which was called The Story of the Constitution. And the occasion for the publishing of this little, humble little book that is so valuable and important in our experience was celebrating the 150th anniversary of the U.S. Constitution at that time, 1787 to 1937, the sesquicentennial anniversary. Well, the editor general of that project was a congressman from New York named Saul Bloom, S-O-L, Saul. And in his foreword to The Story of the Constitution, Aaron and Bill, he described that there are three seminal documents in American political letters. The first, of course, is the Declaration of Independence from the United Kingdom, England at the time, Britain. And that set the bow wave for us, establishing the general principles that are available to us from the Creator, as we see in Galatians chapter 5, as I mentioned a moment ago, stand fast in the liberty wherewith Christ has made you free. And they, so then after the revolution was won and we established the Constitution, it was in the bow wave, if you will, of the Declaration of Independence that room was made for these men to have the liberty and the political, space in the world to construct this grand document, the U.S. Constitution, which memorializes those liberties and freedoms that we get from God, our Creator. And then George Washington's farewell address, which was published on September 19th of 1796, was written on the occasion of Washington declining a third term as president.
Hold that thought right there. I was trying to find a good spot in the story to take a break, but there isn't one. So for lack of a great spot, we'll just take this spot. We'll celebrate a little capitalism here for 2 minutes and be right back. You're going to learn all about how our bizarre politics got to this point, and it isn't quite the accident that you would have it be. Seems like it was really well planned, well laid out. All the documents are at wethepeopleradio.us. I think today is going to be a good music day too. By the way, lots of material for this particular topic, and I just wanted to let people know that we have George Washington's farewell address to the people of the United States. What is the Frankfurt School, and also the California Dynasty of Communism, and a couple other things, all posted on the website for you if you would like to read them, so you don't have to. Burn up your Google search trying to find them. We've got them there for you at wethepeopleradio.us.
So what we're hearing and what we're being taught in the colleges today is no accident, is it?
No, it didn't just happen. All right. Sorry to interrupt the story. Continue on, please.
Well, Aaron and Bill, again, it's a pleasure to join you and your guests, KCNR, this afternoon, or your listeners of KCNR this afternoon. But yes, effectively, to answer Bill's question, kind of in a long cut way, if you will, a roundabout way, is why aren't people aware of George Washington's farewell address to the people of the United States today? And we've gotten as far as the idea that cultural Marxism took hold in the secondary schools and colleges and universities of our country in the 50s, 60s, and to the present moment over the last seven decades, to the point that major touchstones of American heritage and of the American and of the American founding have one by one been picked off and removed from the syllabus that young kids are being taught today. And this began happening, as I say, even in my own experience growing up in the 60s and 70s, on into the 80s through secondary and collegiate education experience. So it's time for us in the country to recover these crown jewels, if you will, for our American Republic. And one of those was George Washington's farewell address to the people of the United States. In fact, as we were talking about a moment ago, Saul Bloom, a congressman from New York, was the editor general of a project in 1937 to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the U.S. Constitution that was called the Sesquicentennial Commission. And they published a book called The Story of the Constitution, which contained the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, bios of the framers of the Constitution, and George Washington's farewell address, which, by an accident of history, was lost to the American people in 1850 and has subsequently been put under wraps by cultural Marxists at the New York Public Library for now going on 167 years. But in his foreword to that book, as we chatted about a moment ago, Bill and Aaron, Saul Bloom, Congressman Bloom, said that there are three seminal documents of American political letters, the first being the Declaration of Independence, which set the bow wave to make all things possible, and the U.S. Constitution, which was made in that pause, which memorializes the God-given rights that we enjoy as Americans, the freedom that we enjoy and the liberty that we enjoy. And then the third of the seminal trinity was George Washington's farewell address to the people, which was written to be a roadmap for the future. It was on keeping in the path of this, experiment of self-governance by the people. So it's in the farewell address then, in 32 handwritten manuscript pages, that we find all of the wisdom of the framers congealed there for us. And I can tell you, Bill and Aaron, if we had had that on hand before the people over the last seven decades, as the Marxists have been gaining traction in all the institutions of our society, including academia, government, and other sectors of our society, media and so forth, entertainment, had those ideas of the farewell address been more squarely in front of the people, we never would have let this thing get as far down the road as it has. And so I think we would all agree that when we see so many young people in the streets so totally confused about who they are and what it means to be an American, we realize that we've gone way, way too far away from our original intention in this country and this experiment of self-governance by the people. So in a nutshell then, to answer your question, Bill, that's kind of how we got here, and now the question is, how are we going to get out of here? Well, obviously we've got to recover the wisdom and the sage counsel that existed in the farewell address, which was penned by Washington in concert with James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. And as I mentioned previously, on the occasion of President Washington, George Washington, declining a third term as president. Now, at the end of his first term, he had contemplated retirement, and he'd spent, several decades of his life in military and public service, as a representative in the House of Burgess in Virginia, as a militia officer, fighting Indians, fighting the French, and then, of course, as the commanding general of the Continental Revolutionary Army. And so then as the chief executive, the founder of our nation, effectively, in that first term. Well, by the end of his first term, however, he realized, after much counsel, including Elizabeth Powell of Philadelphia, who folks may recall was the lady who approached Benjamin Franklin after in the summer of this time in 1787, some 240 years ago. She had asked Ben Franklin, what form of government have you given us, sir? And he said, a republic, if you can keep it. Well, so by the end of the first term for Washington, he realized, again, with counsel from Elizabeth Powell and others, that his person really needed to stay in place, if you will, for the federal government to fully gel around him. So he agreed to stand for election in a second term, and of course was reelected. And then by the end of his second term, however, he felt the federal government had had been congealed enough that he could then retire to private life and return to Mount Vernon to pursue his life as a Virginia planter. So it was on that occasion that he retooled his formerly pigeonholed farewell address that he had contemplated sending to the American people at the end of his first term, which had originally been written by James Madison with Washington's advice and counsel. And then prior to the end of his second term, he had Alexander Hamilton rework that document, and there were several revisions and iterations of it between Hamilton and Washington before the final manuscript, as I say, in 32 handwritten pages under Washington's own hand, were sent to a gentleman named Claypool, David Claypool, who published a circular, a magazine, in the city of Philadelphia called the American Daily Advertiser. And so on the 19th of September then, in 1796, just a couple days after the or I should say in September, just a couple days after the Constitution had been created, and on the 17th of September in 1787, the farewell address hit the streets, if you will, in the mass medium of the day, which of course were periodicals that were published in the major cities throughout the 13 colonies. So Claypool was the first, and then it was likewise copied and then published in the Hartford Courant and other newspapers around the country. But the farewell address, oddly enough, was never actually spoken by Washington. It was just, distributed through the print medium. Well, so that manuscript then sat in the collection and the hands of the personal collection of David Claypool for several years. And then in 1850, when he passed on, his papers came up for auction. And Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky put a bill before President Zachary Taylor to ask the U.S. government to bid on recovering the original manuscript of the farewell address. But literally, the U.S. government was a day late and a dollar short, because President Taylor signed the farewell address on the very day that it was sold at auction to a collector of American memorabilia, a man named James Lennox of New York. Well, so then some years later, when James Lennox passed on, having paid the princely sum at the time of $2,300 for the farewell address,
wow,
Washington's original manuscript, when he passed on, his papers and possessions and so forth went to the New York Public Library. So the manuscript then has been sitting in the bowels of the New York Public Library at 42nd Street in Manhattan now, as I say, for going on 167 years. And it was in 1989 that I put my hand on the story of the Constitution book that, as mentioned, was published by Congress, in which I was first exposed to the tremendous wisdom of the farewell address. And I realized that the American people needed to have this wisdom before them to recapture their heritage and their traditions. So I approached the New York Public Library about going to see the original manuscript, and they refused to allow me to see it. Well, Aaron and Bill, I can tell you I was somewhat dismayed by that, given that the document itself is called the Farewell Address to the People of the United States. And, of course, we are presumably yet a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. In other words, we are sovereign as people. The power resides with us. And so when I spoke with a gentleman named Allie Wiseman at the New York Public Library at 42nd Street in Manhattan, and he refused to allow me to see the manuscript, I said, well, one day, Mr. Wiseman, I can assure you that I will view that manuscript.
Well, if it's in the public library, I guess the $64,000 question is, why couldn't you see it?
Well, yeah, and since it was for the people anyway, and so that's the whole point, Aaron. That really gets right down to the rub of the whole issue. The people should see this thing.
Sure.
Just like the people can see their Declaration of Independence, and I say their Declaration of Independence, and just like the people can see their U.S. Constitution, their Constitution, and both of those original documents, as we know, are on display at the National Archives on the Mall in Washington, D.C.,
right,
at a place called Exhibition Hall. Well, I think what needs to happen then for the farewell address, which again was the roadmap for the future, the path for us forward into all time, and it's clear when you read the farewell address that Washington and Madison and Hamilton, they clearly intended that it was going to be for future generations and not just their own generation. But I think the farewell address needs to be on display next to those two important and seminal documents in our American culture, our American history, and our American politic. And so what we'll need to do
now begins
is
the quest, huh? Hold on one more second. We'll take a really quick break. And just a little personal note. I used to deliver the Hartford Courant when I was a kid.
That's quite interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, you said the Hartford Current. I was like, hey, wait a minute. I delivered the Hartford Current. Yeah. Obviously, I didn't do it. I didn't do it back when George Washington was alive, though. I'm not actually that old, but I mean, I'm pretty old, but not that old. We'll be right back. We are discussing George Washington's farewell address and the importance to our nation and how we can get that back. You can find all of that information and a copy of the address at wethepeopleradio.us. Music today, Bob.
Yeah,
I was expecting Sean Hannity's voice.
No, it's just me, little Aaron Ryan, who used to deliver the Hartford Current. Oh, that's funny. So we're discussing President Washington's farewell address to the people of the United States with our guest, Double X. We've never had somebody who just had letters. I'm kind of I don't know what to call you, Mr. X. I'm having trouble with my coming in and going out.
Yeah, I answer to most anything. Call me anything you like, Aaron. Just don't call me late for supper.
There you go.
There you have it.
I guess since you're at the shooting range, we could just call you Double, you know, and leave the barrel part off.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, that's entirely possible.
Yeah.
So,
That's fascinating that you had delivered papers for the Hartford Current, and I must say that they at least were willing to run a little article on the bicentennial of George Washington's farewell address, which was, of course, in September of 1996. But I can tell you that other entities in the country had no interest whatsoever,
No kidding.
Not the least of which was National Public Radio.
Oh, big shock.
When they were approached about doing something on the bicentennial anniversary of the farewell address, their representative said, and I loosely quote, paraphrase, if you will, "Oh, that was just a bunch of ramblings from middle-aged white men. Who cares about that?"
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I've never heard anything like that lately.
And that's the attitude we get when we pay the bill. It just blows me away, some of the stuff they get away with.
Stunning.
Right.
We lived in Hartford during the bicentennial, actually, in 1976, and that was a huge deal, just a huge deal. I don't know what was happening in the rest of the country, but, you know, we lived in the midst of all the revolutionary, you know, homes and homesteads and all of that. That sort of history was extremely, it was well taught in all of our schools. I went to parochial school and also went to public school in my last year there, and that was, we weren't burying history. And then we came to the West Coast, and there was a lot less history here.
What, out there you learn about American history, about the Revolution. Out here you build missions.
And I guess they're getting rid of that.
Sutter's Fort and the Mexican Territory.
But I was always shocked that kids didn't know much out here about their revolutionary roots. Revolutionary War roots, I should say, and some of their founders, just not a lot of that was being taught out here. Just kind of sad.
Right.
So you started this back in 1989. So that kind of begs the question, what's the holdup exactly? Like for getting this public?
We haven't had a moment we haven't had a moment of leadership that has happened for us, as I think we would agree, Aaron and Bill, until the present instant. And I refer in particular to the general election of 2016 last year and the election of Donald J. Trump as President of the United States, the 45th President of the United States, and I believe the leader of the Second American Revolution. And so I think that's where the answer lay. We have a strong president who's willing to stand up for American values, who himself happens to be a New Yorker, who has financial resources and the wherewithal to try to rescue that manuscript from the New York Public Library in Manhattan and bring it to the American people once again. And once that manuscript is brought out of the shadows among the dusty tomes there at 42nd Street in Manhattan, then the light of liberty will begin to shine much more brightly, because the original wisdom of Washington and Madison and Hamilton, as they reflected from their contemporaries, the framers and the founders of our country, all of that will be much more immediately available to us, and we'll fully understand as Americans what the intentions were for this limited government constitutional republic.
That makes a lot of sense. Have you had a chance to speak with people in the administration yet, or are you, I mean, I realize they haven't been there that long, but.
Yeah, during the general election season, it was interesting to see, Aaron. We forwarded some material and information about the farewell address to President Trump, suggesting that the greatest president of the United States was the first one, George Washington. There's just absolutely no question about that. He truly is the founder of our country and the father of our country, if you will. President Trump finds himself at a moment in history where it's time to recover that, you know, that American idea, and he's doing his very best to do so. And so it made sense for Trump to start talking about George Washington and his leadership during the Revolution and during the founding of our nation. And so we forwarded information about the farewell address to him, and oddly enough, inside of 2 or 3 weeks on the campaign trail, as he made his characteristic speeches around the country at Trump rallies, he began to talk about George Washington. And we further forwarded to him some taxation innovation ideas. And that included something that Andrew Jackson, President Jackson, talked about and followed through on, which is to kill centralized banking in our country, which he did in effect in 1836. Now, it's no accident, Aaron and Bill, that when you look at pictures of President Trump's Oval Office, you see on the right wall next to his desk, as you face his desk, a portrait of President Jackson, a horseback, as well as a statue of him. So Trump understands where the touchstones are in our country, and those are two of the most important ones. So it's just a question of if he can get his administration, you know, populated with people who actually want to follow through on what he was elected to do. And that's the wrestling match that's going on in the swamp there in the Beltway right now. Now, I have it from a colleague of mine who has spent many hours and days and months and years in shadowy places, and he says that there are departments in the government right now that are responsible, as an example, for background checks, federal background checks for employees. And what might be a 90-day process ends up becoming an interminable process. And so it ends up being a bottleneck, if you will, for Trump to populate his administration with supporters and red-blooded American patriots to grab back our country and to get it back on the right track. So these are the battles that are being waged right now.
And I could totally.
As folks walk it.
Yeah, we can see, you know, I mean, even if all you're doing is watching the regular news, you can pretty much see that happening. Hey, we've got Kay on the line for you. She's got a comment, I think.
Hi, Aaron and Bill.
Oh, sure.
I didn't get the name of your guest.
He goes by Double X.
Oh, Double X. Okay. I might be interested to know that there's a tradition in the United States Senate that the junior senator from Virginia reads Washington's farewell address on George Washington's birthday.
You're absolutely right, Kay. It's actually the junior senator of the U.S. Senate, and the Senate keeps a logbook of those senators who have had occasion to do so,
it's always the junior senator from Virginia. Because George Washington
not in the federal Senate.
Huh?
Not in the federal Senate, no.
It's senators
from all around the country.
I know,
and
but
the
person who reads it is the junior senator from the state of Virginia. That's the tradition.
Well, Kay, there's a
lot
of...
I've been there, and I know.
Okay, well,
okay.
I don't think we're going to solve it right this minute.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think that Washington's farewell address is as obscure as you think it is. Thank you very much. Bye.
All righty.
Thanks, Kay.
Well, the farewell address is not obscure to respond to Kay's comment. But what is obscure is people don't know where the original manuscript is. But to answer to the record, the Senate keeps a logbook of the folks of the junior senator that gives a recitation of the farewell address at the opening of each session. And that practice in the U.S. Senate continues to the present moment. And as I was saying a moment ago, Senator McCain, Senator Hatch of Utah, and some other well-known senators have all been junior senators that have given that recitation. But the point that I was going to make for Kay's consumption, which she may be interested in, she may be aware of, it sounds, in the U.S. House of Representatives, they also had a junior freshman congressman at the opening of each session read the farewell address into the halls of the House. But in 1980, the House decided they no longer had time for that, and so they ceased the practice. Well, I found that the timing on that, Aaron and Bill, very interesting, because that's just about when what we would call gridlock in Washington, D.C., in other words, the perennial conflict between the two parties in D.C., where the people's business suffers and nothing gets done, all of that really began to get traction when they just coincident to the timing of them no longer paying any attention to the fundamentals of George Washington's farewell address. And it's funny, in the farewell address, Washington talks about let the administration be stamped with wisdom and virtue. And he talked about the spirit of the party, which he said is a flame that instead of warming may consume, and that it enfeebles the administration and distracts the public councils. And in effect, Aaron and Bill, I think we would agree that that has been the state of our government from 1980 on to the present.
And do you think that's a big part of why it's becoming more obscure? Because that is a fact, that we are being consumed with party.
Hey, and I also wanted to put, I'm in the cone of silence, sorry. Also, I just looked up the United States Senate. It's senate.gov, and I'll post the link, but Ben Sasse was the most recent person to read. They have the list every year since
they
started doing it, and actually they are all states. So since February 22nd, 1888, the first reader of this was from Kansas, then Nebraska, Kansas, Maine. It goes on. Everybody's,
I think that's what Kay was referring to.
Yeah, everybody's kind of represented, so... if you'd like to look at that link, it's at senate.gov, but I will post it on our webpage.
Right. Now, this whole idea of the Senate and the House taking reference to the farewell address, Aaron and Bill, and for the listeners and for Kay, it all started in 1862. And the occasion was, of course, the nation at that time was convulsed in civil war. So a thousand citizens in Philadelphia, concerned about the fate of the Union, they petitioned President Lincoln and the legislature to hearken back to the wisdom contained in Washington's farewell address. So on Washington's birthday, on the 22nd of February in 1862, there was a convening of the Senate, the House, the administration, including the vice president, the Senate historian, the sergeant at arms, and President Lincoln was unable to attend. His son had just passed away. And so there was the first reading in public of the farewell address, and it takes about 45 minutes to do so. And then from that point forward, people began to think a little bit more about the farewell address, and ultimately, as you've described, Aaron, there in the 1880s, it became a tradition in the Senate to actually have a junior senator read it into the halls of the Senate at the opening of each session. So there is this tradition of us hearkening back to the farewell address. But to Kay's point, I think we would agree that if you put a microphone in front of 10 people walking the street mm-hmm. and ask them if they knew anything of George Washington's farewell address or could recite any of the principles contained therein, that you'd probably come up with something less than 10% of respondents, you know?
Yeah, and true. And I know that our classes, because we grew up back there, we would go to Washington, D.C., and you would view all the original documents. And so, yeah, the idea that the original document's in the basement of a library that they won't let anyone see, and it isn't part of our openly displayed founding documents, that is a little weird.
Yeah, it is. So that gets us back to that question then. Okay, well, how did the cultural Marxists get such traction here? Well, as you've mentioned, Aaron, you've posted on your We the People Radio website an article that's very handy, which in five pages does a brilliant job of tracking that trajectory from the 1930s when the cultural Marxists hit our shores to the present moment. And the name of that article is What is the Frankfurt School?, written by Commander Jerry Atkinson, a retired U.S. Navy commander who still resides in Maryland today, and also a University of Michigan graduate and Ph.D. in nuclear physics. Jerry Atkinson was the Navy's representative during the SALT talks in the 1980s, the arms reduction talks between the U.S. and the Soviet Union at the time. But he was also and is a brilliant scholar and historian. Well, he wrote a series of articles for the U.S. Naval Academy, and What is the Frankfurt School was one of those articles. And what he observed in the Naval Academy syllabus is that under the rubric of political correctness and the cultural Marxism of psychology and so forth, that midshipmen in the U.S. Naval Academy and the other military service academies were being inundated by what he described as the psychological programming of a guy named Wilhelm Wundt, W-U-N-D-T. And it got so bad that in 1994, Jerry Atkinson makes note in What is the Frankfurt School of an occasion that happened at the commencement exercise for the midshipmen.
We'll have to hold that until after the news because it's going to cut us off in like 5 seconds. We will be right back, and we have Double X as our hostage for another hour. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. All the documents are posted. Be right back.